While the clock is ticking for some Haitians here in the United States, others in Haiti are leaving their country for South America. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Tens of thousands of Haitians living in the U.S. under temporary protected status have through the summer of 2019 to either find another way to stay here or leave. How are they preparing to leave, or are they fighting to stay? Meantime, many in Haiti looking to leave are going to Chile, but the mass migration there has created a backlash from some Chileans. We'll look at the story of Haitians trying to find a new home. In Palm Beach County, there are 34 designated areas of dunes, wetlands, scrub, and flatwood forest, all protected. But the county's running out of money to maintain those areas. We'll talk to one group fighting to protect that funding. All of that coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, there are more than 31,000 acres of natural land in Palm Beach County that face a threat. And we're not talking about the encroaching seas or invasive animals or overdevelopment. The money that's used by the county to protect and maintain those lands, 34 different sites, well, that money's running out. Palm Beach County commissioners were supposed to look at the issue today at the regularly scheduled commission meeting, which is underway now, but that issue was taken off the agenda. Groups fighting to protect those lands intend to speak up at today's meeting anyway. Scott Zucker from Audubon Everglades has led a move to gather more than 1,000 cards from residents asking commissioners to properly fund these lands. And again, he's at that commission meeting now. Scott Zucker, pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
All right, the issue was supposed to be discussed in today's meeting. When did you find out that they had taken it off the list for discussion?
I found out about a week ago that they were supposed to be discussing using tourist development dollars, and that is no longer apparently available due to statutory limitations of how to use those dollars.
And that was the reason they gave you? There was no other reason why they took it off the list? There's no other discussion about it?
No, there's no other discussion currently on today's agenda. So we are going to be speaking during the matters before the public portion of the agenda.
All right. You're there to bring commissioners hundreds of cards that residents have been signing. What are you asking of the commission?
So we're basically asking fund the natural areas with the amount of money that ERM, which is Environmental Resources Management, is asking to properly maintain those almost 32,000 acres of preserved property that was paid for by Palm Beach County taxpayer dollars and has been restored and is being currently used by thousands and thousands of residents of Palm Beach County and visitors alike.
And the cards, what exactly do they say? And how are you collecting them?
So it's a Have a Heart campaign, and we're asking the commissioners to have a heart. And we basically told residents who we met at churches, at fairs, at festivals, some even went door to door within their communities. And we just asked them to say whatever they basically had in their heart about why they felt that these natural areas should be funded.
All right. Describe these designated areas. There's 34 of them in the county.
There's actually 37.
37. Thank you for correcting me.
And so they vary tremendously from small, under 100-acre habitats to some that are 14,000 acres. They're mostly wetlands, but they're also scrub, pine, and oak flatwood habitats, dune estuaries, lagoons. So it basically runs the gamut of all the habitats within Palm Beach County.
And what are they used for? I mean, do people actually use these lands for anything? Or just, I mean, again, as you said, some are wetlands, so they do play another ecological role. But are they used by people in any other way?
Sure. They're used. I'll just give you the list of people who use them. So we see school children, families, anglers, hikers, kayakers, and canoers, bird watchers, bicyclists, runners, and even dark sky observers, and wildlife and outdoor enthusiasts all use these areas.
Okay. It sounds like you might be in one of those wetlands. It's kind of loud there.
Well, I'm actually outside.
Okay.
Looking over the landscape of downtown West Palm Beach on the sixth floor of the county courthouse building.
I see. If it's possible, if you could get back inside, just so we can hear you clearly, my apologies. But I wanted to ask you, the funding for the upkeep of these lands is shrinking, and that's the big problem here. It faces a more than 50% decline in funding this year, and it could run out of money by 2019. Why? Correct. How did we get to this place?
Well, formerly, there were dollars set aside to fund the natural areas. There were transfer development rights dollars based on fees assigned to developers who want to develop additional properties within areas that were designated for higher density. And those fees, after 2008, were cut out. And so they're no longer getting any money from those fees at all. There was an endowment that they do still receive some money for, but not nearly enough. And so everything else has to basically, at this point, come out of some budgetary area that the county comes up with.
How much would be necessary for these programs to be fully funded?
Fully funded, we're looking at least $6 million.
And what if the county can no longer pay that? Then what?
Okay, if the county can no longer pay that, what will happen is they will ERM, which is, again, Environmental Resources Management, will have to cut back on maintenance. And the main focus of the maintenance dollars goes into controlling invasive exotics, which I understand last year was $4 million alone just for invasive exotic control. And that is so necessary, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, because that is needed to allow natives to have a foothold for aquifer recharge, for water purification. And if we lose that, if we allow the native exotic to come in, it's going to cost us many, many more times that amount of money later in order to get these areas back under management control.
All right. There are people planning to speak during the public hearing segment of the meeting today. How many, and what are they going to say?
Well, I know that there are a number of NGOs here, which are local nonprofits. There are former directors from ERM who will be here. There are community leaders who will be here. And I think all will be here to encourage the commissioners to fund these areas. We don't know where these dollars can come from. We know that last year's budget was $4.5 billion for Palm Beach County. Approximately $75 million went for parks and recreation in Palm Beach County. And so we're just asking for a small percentage of that total budget to fund our natural areas.
So what are you going to do next? I mean, it's about finding that money. What can you do?
Well, as a citizen, I can keep reminding the commissioners how valuable this is, how valuable and how important these properties are to their constituents. I will be meeting with them over the next couple of months individually to encourage them. Perhaps it may come down in the future to a referendum in order to get these dollars. A referendum was passed in 1991 where we received $50 million. And 1999, where we received $100 million in order to purchase these properties. And in 2014, Palm Beach County led the state of Florida percentage-wise. 85% voted for Amendment $1, which was, of course, to purchase land and to protect our water.
Again, I've been talking with Scott Zucker from Audubon Everglades, and he is at the Palm Beach County Commission meeting. They took off their agenda any discussion about funding for these natural lands. Again, 37 different sites, over 31,000 acres of natural land, money needed every year to maintain those lands. And those lands are used in many different ways. Scott Zucker, it's been a pleasure. We'll keep up with you and find out what's going on.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it. I appreciate everything that you are doing by having me on your show to support this issue.
All right. Thanks again, Scott.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You know what? We want to hear from you on this. You can find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. If you live in Palm Beach County, you know some of these lands. You probably pass by them all the time. Do you use them? Let us know your thoughts on, again, money running out to maintain those lands. What would happen if that money had run out? Again, find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. All right, coming up on the program, Haitians in the U.S. and in Haiti searching for a new home. That's all next here on Sundial and WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, 7 years ago, fewer than 1,000 Haitians left their home country for Chile. By last year, that had increased 100-fold. Almost 100,000 Haitians immigrated to Chile last year. That's almost 1% of Haiti's population. The flood of people comes as the U.S. has cracked down on immigration and canceled temporary protective status granted to Haitians after the 2010 earthquake. But what Haitians are finding in Chile may not be opportunity. They may be finding discrimination, resentment, even racism. One local Chilean mayor created this song and video to reach young Haitians with a message that life in Chile may not be all they hoped it is. And there are actually two versions of that, one in Spanish, one in Creole. We're joined now by Jacqueline Charles from the Miami Herald, who reported a series of stories exploring the Haitian-Chilean connection. And she joins us from the studios in Doral. Jacqueline Charles, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First, briefly explain this history and relationship between Chile and Haiti. It goes back a ways.
Well, it does go back a ways. What's interesting is that in the 1970s, early 70s, you had a number of Haitians who went to Chile, but they went to the university. And so what we've seen, though, in the last couple of years following the January 12, 2010 earthquake is Haitians are now going to Chile to stay. And that relationship actually started with Chile's involvement in Haiti after the fall of former President Aristide in 2004. Chilean troops, they came to Haiti. And then all of a sudden, Haitians started looking at Chile as, you know, hey, you know, that's a place that maybe we can go to. So the fact that Chile had peacekeepers in Haiti, they don't require Haitians to have visas. So all they need is a passport, $1,000 pocket money, and a plane ticket. It has just opened up Chile as a place for Haitians to migrate to.
But when and how did Chile become this place Haitians saw as this land of great promise?
You know, that really coincided with Brazil. What happened after the 2010 earthquake is that a number of Haitians were starting to go to Brazil. If we recall, Brazil was preparing for the Olympics. They were preparing for the World Cup. So there was a lot of construction jobs that were available in Brazil. And then the economy started to tank. And so Haitians who were already in South America said, you know what, we need to go someplace else. We need to start to make a living. And they started going to Chile. So we started seeing this wave of people going to Chile. And a lot of times they were going to Chile to work, to earn money so that they can get to the U.S.-Mexico border in order to try to get into the United States. But then as that door started to shut on them, which started happening from Haiti, is that word of mouth just started spreading about the job opportunities that were available in Chile, that this is a country that you don't need a visa to go to. And so last year, we saw 105,000 Haitians travel to Chile. That is the equivalent of 1% of Haiti's population.
I want to know what do people in Haiti think they're going to find in Chile? I get that it's jobs, but what's the perception that, you know, they're going to experience when they arrive in Chile?
That it's El Dorado, that it's paradise, that
where is that coming from? Who's saying that?
Well, what's happening is the people who arrive in Chile, and we have to think about this demographic, they are between the ages of 15 and 44. Okay, a lot of them are educated. They have never worked or have been unable to find consistent employment in Haiti. And their reasoning is that the misery that I am living today, it cannot be any worse if I go someplace else. So when they arrive in Chile, they are going on Facebook and, you know, or they're in their WhatsApp profiles and they're, you know, showing pictures of themselves out or working, or they're projecting this image that things are great and wonderful. But what they don't translate home is the fact that if they are working, it's 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hour days, that on average it takes a Haitian 4 months to find a job. Often that job is what we are familiar with in terms of under the table, because they are not completely legal. When they arrive in Chile as tourists, they are legally in the country for 90 days. But then in order for you to get a work permit to stay there legally, to become a resident, resident. You need to find a work contract. Well, when you go to an employer, he says to you, well, do you have a Chilean ID number? And you say no. So then you go to immigration to apply for an ID number. They said, but before we give you an ID number, do you have a work contract? So it becomes this catch-22, which comes first, the chicken or the egg. And so some people do eventually, you know, they get that work contract, they get that employment, but it's at what price? They're living in apartments the size of an area rug. They're being charged three times the legal amount that is required under the, that is allowed under the law for rent. And as I mentioned earlier, 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hour days, there isn't much time for any sort of social activity.
So it's so interesting. You sit there and you tell me that they think it's El Dorado. And yet, you know, there was one of the Haitians you spoke to in your series said, Chile is a real deception. And I'm wondering, why does that message not get across?
I ask this question continuously to every Haitian that talked to me about how difficult it was or how they were suffering. And I said, but why don't you tell people back in Haiti that it's not what they think? And they said, you know what? Haitians are like, they're doubting Thomases. They have to see it to believe it. If you tell them don't come, if you tell them how bad it is, they think that you're lying, that you're hiding something from them, that you don't want them to enjoy what you're enjoying. So they have to come and see. And so those that are there, when you talk to them and they are now experiencing it, you know what they say? The part of the problem is, one, it's so far away from Haiti, so it's not like you can turn around and leave. Two, they've overstayed the 90 days, so that return ticket is no longer valid. Three, they've invested so much. You know, the ticket to Chile from Haiti is about $1,500, plus there's that $1,000. And people have gone through enormous sacrifices in order to get somebody to Chile. So for you to go back to Haiti empty-handed or worse off than when you left, so it's not so easy for them. You know, so they say, I'm going to try to struggle it out. But what we have started to see, even before this recent crackdown, is that Haitians have been returning because they've started to realize, you know what, this is not paradise and this is not easy.
You know, we played a little clip of that video at the introduction of this segment. It was Rodrigo Delgado. He's the mayor of the district there of Santiago called Estación Central. And he commissioned this video. I mean, again, from your story. We heard part of it. It's called Vida Extranjera, or Foreign Life, and it's produced by an artist known as Black Pete. He's a Chilean-based Haitian artist. What does the song say exactly?
It basically is saying to them, listen, if you're going to come to Chile, you need to be prepared. You need to understand that there's poor people everywhere. So here, you can be poor, that there's racism everywhere, and here you're going to experience racism. You know, it is not what you think in your mind that it is. And that's what happens. A lot of these Haitians, when they're preparing to go to Chile, a lot of them don't speak the language. They don't put it in their mind that they can spend 4 months without working. They don't plan for that. The money that they take as pocket money, they immediately send it back to Haiti so that it can be recycled and used by someone else. And so their stay in Chile becomes much more difficult than it is. When I spoke to Rodrigo Central, and it's interesting, he's a member of the new president, Sebastián Piñera's coalition, but he's very progressive in his thinking in terms of Haitian migration and migration in general. And he says, look, I don't have the moral authority to tell Haitians to come or not to come, but they need to be prepared. You know, his office has done a lot to integrate Haitians. They've provided an app, an education app that's in Creole. Their website was the first in Chile to have Creole. They have Creole speakers in the hospitals and also in the school system. But even with all of that, he says, you know, on every given day, we can have Haitians come into our office with their suitcases from the airport saying, hey, I'm here. I need help. I need a place to stay. I need a job. And their hands are up. It's like, what do you do?
Again, I'm talking with Jacqueline Charles, Miami Herald reporter. And she had a series that came out recently, and it's looking at this story of Haitians leaving Haiti, going to Chile because they think there are a lot of opportunities there. Chile is one of the more economically stable countries of South America, and they believe that there's opportunity for work and a better life. They get there and they realize that's not really the case. It's a fascinating series, and we'll have a link to it on our website so you can check it out. You can find it on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Jacqueline, where are Haitians arriving when they get there? Where are they arriving and what happens? They get off the plane, then what?
Exactly. So they get off the plane, and it's a direct flight. There are several direct flights from Port-au-Prince, although one of which was just pulled by the Chilean government. They just had their operating license temporarily canceled, and we're watching that. But they arrive off the plane, and usually sometimes they have people who are waiting for them. Sometimes it may be relatives or friends, or sometimes if they're working through a middleman, somebody who's arranged their trips, those individuals are working for them. So one of the individuals, young man Stanley, who I interviewed in my story, he says when he arrived there, someone met him and they took him to an apartment. And he was told by the gentleman, well, you have to pay $300 for the taxi because taxis are expensive here. That's $300 U.S. You know, so right there, he's already being taken advantage of. And then usually people will say, listen, I can get you a work permit, but it's going to cost you X hundreds of dollars. And so often they do this, not knowing that in Chile, you can't buy a work permit. And if you end up buying it and you're allowed to work, when you go to file your legal papers for residency, the Chilean government will say, you know what, you had a fake document, and so we're going to give you this deportation order. So they spend the next month or the next year fighting deportation. So oftentimes they're taking advantage of because they don't understand how this place works. Chile is a highly regulated society. You know, there are a lot of laws, there are a lot of regulations there, and that's something that's very different from what Haitians are used to.
Again, I'm talking with Jacqueline Charles of the Miami Herald, and we're going to continue this conversation talking about, again, the story of Haitians going to Chile because they're looking for a better opportunity. They think that's the place that they need to go to find work, make money, and support their families. But as we've learned from the series, from Jacqueline's series, that's not the case, that Chile is not the El Dorado, it's not the paradise. And that maybe a lot of Chileans are really not happy with the fact that so many Haitians are going to their country looking for work. We're going to find out more on that story coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And again, I was talking with Jacqueline Charles, a reporter with the Miami Herald, about a series that she just published looking at Haitians who are leaving Haiti and going to Chile looking for opportunity. They believe that it's a paradise with lots of jobs and lots of opportunities to make money to support their families. But we're finding out, no, Chile isn't everything they think it is. And now there's a growing resentment, a racism from Chileans towards many of these Haitians. In the last year, over 100,000 plus Haitians have migrated to Chile. That's almost 1% of Haiti's population. Jacqueline, Chile has a new president. He just took office.
Yes, he has. And during the presidential elections, there was a lot of discourse about these, you know, immigrants. And it not just was Haitians, because you also have to understand that Chile also has seen a very sharp increase in the number of Venezuelans who are coming there. And that's also making it difficult for the Haitians because the Venezuelans already have the language and the culture. They speak Spanish. They're familiar with the Latin culture. And so while Haitians at one point found a lot of job opportunities in Chile, now it's becoming increasingly difficult. It's saturated, especially Santiago. So that adds to the challenges. And now with Piñera, who's come in and he's talked about, for instance, one of the things that he wants to do is to have clear rules and regulations. This is when one of his advisors, you know, spoke to me about. But what does that mean? It's unclear. Does that mean that they're going to now require visas of Haitians who want to travel to Chile? Piñera did this during his first term with Dominicans when they were having large numbers, waves of Dominican migrants coming into Chile. He then slapped visas on them. He's talked about not giving migrants access to the public health system unless it is an emergency. But if you're in Chile and you're not there legally, then you should not have access to the public hospitals. That's something that he touted on the campaign trail. So today, a lot of people are watching President Piñera to see what his moves in regard to migration and immigration will be.
Something you pointed out in the story is how many Chileans see themselves, that this is a country that is very white. And so now you have this migration, this mass migration of Haitians coming in. How are Chileans viewing this?
It's very interesting because Chileans do view themselves as not just white, but whiter than most in Latin America. There is a very tiny population of Afro-Chilenos, but they are on the northern coast. So there are actually people in Chile who never had met a black person until these Haitians, you know, arrived. So you have people who right now are looking at this and saying, you know what, in the beginning, they felt that they were helping the poor Haitians, you know, after their country was struck by an earthquake. But now some are feeling like they're being invaded, you know, and when they describe the migration, they often use words associated with water. But I think a lot of that also is rooted in the fact that Chile's economy is not as strong as it used to be. And so you have a lot of Chileans who themselves are having to go into the informal sector and find themselves competing with migrants for, you know, for jobs.
Would you describe the anti-immigrant sentiment there as comparable to anything you've seen here in the United States?
You know, I went back and forth with this when I was talking to a Chilean sociologist who was quoted in the story. And I said, but, you know, one can argue that in the United States, you know, there's every day there are cases, dozens of cases of racism. And so, and some can argue that in Chile, you know, you only have maybe a few cases. And his position is that one is too much, that that it's not just, you know, the cases of racism, but it's the views that Chileans have. I spoke to a businessman who was very well-meaning. I mean, he hired a Haitian worker 2 days after the young man arrived there, and he feels that it's his Christian duty. But even when he was talking about the relationship and what he had done, and he was saying, you know, they don't steal from you. Even in that view, it came off as sort of racist, right? That you expected that they were going to steal because they're Haitians, but he didn't recognize, you know, what he was saying. Or the comedian that I quoted in the story when he was pointing out the fact that this couple was eating a vanilla ice cream, and he says, well, it's a good thing it's not chocolito, otherwise you would eat your fingers. And he thought it was funny, and he didn't understand why that remark, you know, was a little bit racist there. So I think for Chile, it's a learning process. But one of the things I found is that you had a government that didn't necessarily say come, but it made it easy for Haitians to migrate to Chile. But it did not prepare its population for these migrants who looked different, spoke a completely different language, and say, okay, this is an opportunity for us to integrate and to really sort of move forward. Because Chile has built its whole population on immigration, on migration, but it's been from Europe. It hasn't been from Haiti or other parts of Latin America. And today that is changing.
Did you see any friction between the Haitians and Chileans when it came to faith, to their religious faiths?
Well, you know what's interesting? Haitians are Catholics, you know, for the most part. I mean, Haiti is majority Catholic. But I kept running into a lot of Protestants among the Haitians, and I kept trying to figure out, like, you know, what is going on here? And when I was talking to another mayor, the mayor of Quilicura, and he was talking about integration and the importance of integration, one of the things that bothered him was the fact that the Haitians, when they worship separately. They did not worship together with the Chileans. And I was trying to have him understand that, you know, when Haitians are outside of Haiti, they rely so much on their faith. So even someone who is Catholic, you may see them turning to the Protestant church because they want to have that religious authority be somebody who speaks their language and they can understand. So I didn't see that, but I will tell you an interesting story. I myself did experience a lot of tensions as a reporter. This was a very difficult assignment for me. Now, I was there the week that the alleged comments from the president about the whole in terms of Haiti and El Salvador. But a couple of days prior to that, I was having a very hard time, you know, getting Haitians to talk to me and to open up. And I was trying to figure out what the problem was. And what happened was that there was a Chilean television station that had gone to Haiti, and they had spent a month in Haiti documenting why Haitians were leaving Haiti. They were doing the same thing that I was doing. I was doing it from the perspective of why they were coming to Chile. This television station went to see why they were leaving Haiti. And the week I was there, they started to air this documentary, and a lot of the images that they were showing of Haiti were very negative images, you know, images of trash, and just they weren't showing the beaches or the hotels or the beautiful mountains. And so Haitians were very bothered by this. I mean, they were angry by it. I had one young man at a place who started crying, and I said, well, what's the problem? He says, because now they're going to start to look at me like this, and they're going to think that this is me. And right there, you saw the burden of the racism, of the discrimination that Haitians were living with, that even when they didn't always recognize it or they just sort of pushed it under the rug, the fact that this image of Haiti was now being broadcast to all of Chile, every Haitian all of a sudden felt exposed, because they don't want to be under the radar. They don't want to be noticed. They just want to be able to get up, make a living, and just, you know, go about their lives without being a bother, without being focused on. And so a lot of that tension came on me, because people also assumed that I was the Haitian reporter who had given this Chilean documentary, these Chilean journalists, access to Haiti in order to project these images.
So the Haitians were, it actually was Haitians coming at you.
Yes.
Thinking that you were the one who was helping them create that image.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, to wrap up here, I was just curious if, again, they may view Chile as a paradise or at least a place for better opportunity, but is life in Chile better considering what may be happening at home in Haiti?
Well, you know what? You trade one set of hardship for another. As one of the young men who I spoke to was describing to me, you know, in Haiti, he worked a tourism job. He was making about $70 a month. And if his kids got sick, he could not afford to take them to a hospital. And he worried about that. And that was ultimately the reason why he went to Chile. In Chile, he's working in a factory and he's making good money, about $500 a month. But he doesn't have his children there. He doesn't have his wife there. He's very lonely. And Chile is not a place where he sees himself rooted, you know, buying his dream house or living out his life. And so you trade, you know, that economic insecurity for another type of insecurity. So I think that is a question that every Haitian find themselves having to answer. It's like, okay, I left this behind in Haiti, and now I'm here, but is it actually better? Because as they will say to me, you know what, in Haiti, if I weren't working, I would still eat. I would still have my family around me. But here in Chile, you have to work to pay bills.
And in 30 seconds, if you could, what's the impact of Haiti losing 1% of its population?
I think it's a huge impact, because as somebody described it, it's the cream of the country. Who's going to be left tomorrow to move this country forward when all of your youth are basically fleeing like that? What is going to be left?
Jacqueline Charles, again, reporter with the Miami Herald. Check out the series looking at Haitians going to Chile, looking for opportunity and finding a lot of other things that they didn't expect. Jacqueline Charles, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Again, she joined us from the studios in Doral. Well, coming up next, what's going to happen to the Haitians and other immigrants here in the U.S. who are dependent on temporary protected status and they are no longer able to stay? And if you are one of them, we'd like to hear from you. The number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. More on this coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN.
We prepare them for the worst, and we organize for the best to find a permanent solution to allow them to stay.
That was our next guest back in late November, just a week after the Trump administration canceled temporary protection status for Haitians, effective in July of next year. Marlene Bastian is the executive director of Haitian Women of Miami, or FAM. And we want to hear from you. If you are one of those Haitians who've lost your TPS, what are you going to do now? What questions do you have about your options? Share that story or your questions, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Marlene Bastian, a pleasure to have you back.
A pleasure to have me, Luis. Thank you so much.
Well, you know what? I mean, look, you got to hear some of Jacqueline's story as well. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about that. But first, let's get back to Haitians living here in the U.S. They still have a little over a year and a few months before that TPS ends. And then what happens next? But what are people who've lost that TPS doing in that time? Are they preparing to leave, or are they still fighting to try to stay?
Yes, thank you. First, I'd like to indicate that at our fundraising activity event on Saturday, we launched our new name. So FAM has a new acronym. It's Family Action Network Movement. Still FAM, but okay. Family Action Network movement, because we've expanded our reach. We're serving, you know, a diverse group of constituents right now, so the name didn't fit anymore. If it didn't fit, then we have to replace.
Okay.
And then Jacqueline was a wonderful keynote speaker on Saturday. She did a fantastic job. So what are the TPS recipients doing? As I indicated back in November, we were organizing for the best and preparing for the worst. And then what we've been doing at FUM is inviting every TPS holder to come to FUM and have a clear or complete assessment of your case, because it was found that some TPS recipients did have some other forms of relief, even though they were not necessarily cognizant of it. So that's what we're doing. That's number one. Number two, we still have our meetings every other Thursday. We had a pause last week because of our gala, but we are starting again next week with our meetings, and then we continue to encourage members to come and get trained on how to transfer your wealth. Who do you give your power of attorney to? These are the things that we are preparing them for. And then lastly, we are working with different groups around the nations that are filing lawsuits, as you know, to protect the TPS recipients. And we want to make sure that they are aware of what's going on. And then we are working on our organizing a strategic plan to meet with lawmakers in Washington, D.C., and then to organize not only locally but also nationally.
Something I remember you told me was that there are people who they have the ability to stay. There may be a way for them to stay. That, you know, legally, there may be some system that they have yet to look into that they could apply for certain things. But you had told me that, right? That there are
Yes, I did. And that's why we are encouraging all the TPS holders, those who are listening right now, to come to FUM or go to AIJ, Catholic Charities, Legal Services, go to an organization that has the expertise, right, to do your assessment. Because there are a lot of people out there who are being taken advantage of by notaries, you know, who claim to know what's going on, who claim to have the know-how to help them, but they do not. So that's why we encourage TPS recipients to go to a center, to an organization that is really specialized in immigration.
Since the last time we talked in late November, after the announcement came down that Homeland Security was ending TPS for Haitians, and again, they have till 2019, June, July 2019, how many people have come forward? I mean, have a lot of people come forward looking to you for advice or information?
Not a lot.
No.
But we encourage them to come.
Why not? What do you think?
I think it takes time for the words to go out. People are still engaged. We're still engaged in, you know, reapplying. You know, it takes time. They have to find money. If you have a family of five, you have to find money to pay for the work permit for all of them. You know, it takes time for people to come. But I must say that some have come, and then that is encouraging. And we continue to encourage them to come. And then we also try to reach out nationally, because there are TPS recipients, you know, in Chicago, in New York. So we reach out to other organizations to make sure that the message, you know, get out.
How much of it is fear, though? Fear like, this is about to end, now what? And so they're afraid to come forward and say anything, because now they've got a plan for the next step, and that could be either to leave or to hide.
Yes. There's the fear factor. There's also the idea that I have time. But time runs fast. So they don't have that much time. July 2019, it's not a long time. So there's fear involved, and you're right, because this environment has really created a lot of fear, high level of anxiety among patients. I mean, we have members coming to FUM saying that they were hospitalized because they cannot sleep. They have anxiety attacks. And then suddenly with Haitian TPS holders, with all immigrants, because realize that immigrants who've been reporting for supervision, not who have committed any crime, when they report for supervision, whether they left children at home or not, they are detained for no reason. So there is a climate of high, you know, of fear that is created, and families are really feeling the impact.
I know that I've read stories about DACA kids who are, or, you know, DACA recipients who are worried about if they don't have that protection, that there is no, the option of leaving the country isn't there. They're going to have to go underground. They have to hide. Have you heard that with folks who lose their TPS? They're ready to just go underground and start hiding.
Even lawmakers, when we took TPS recipients to Washington, D.C. to meet with lawmakers, some of them said, we don't know what's going on because our policies are actually creating an underground population, people who would have to go into hiding. And this is too sad because why would you uproot DACA recipients? They've never been anywhere else. Some of them came here as babies. The U.S. is all they know. Why uprooting them? They are our valedictorians. They are our engineers, our teachers, our community organizers. Why uprooting them to send them to nations? A lot of them in turmoil these days. It doesn't make any sense. So, yes, some people are considering, contemplating going underground. Because, I mean, Luis, I mean, think about it. I mean, your mom, your dad, you're a young DACA recipient, and that's all you know. And then you don't know. Sometimes you don't know the language. Sometimes you don't have any family left in Salvador, in Haiti, in the West, and other places. And then what are you to do? So these policies that this administration, you know, is implementing is actually creating an underground, group of folks.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. We'd like to hear your story. Maybe you have a question about this, or maybe you have a point of view on this issue. We'd like to hear about it. Let's go to, I'm going to start with Jay in Miami. Jay, thanks so much for joining us.
I am here. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Jay.
I would like to explain something to you. I'm an employer with Hondurans with TPS for in excess of 20 years. And you're talking about people that have never taken a government dollar or handout. And I'm just so saddened by what went on with the Trump administration with the holding up of their TPS this year at New Year's Eve, and the fact that you have people that are contributing to the economy, pay their taxes, and because under the TPS status they can't get citizenship, now they're going to be kicked out of the country. My small business is going to be thrown up in disarray, and I don't know what the real answer is anymore. Why is this going on to make the Trump administration look like big bullies for the rest of the Midwest? It just doesn't happen.
Can I ask
properly,
if I may, Jay, because you're an employer, and so you have employees who are, you know, here under TPS, and so if they have to leave, as you said, this is going to hurt you. How are you preparing for that day when their deadline is up?
I'm just going to retire and go bankrupt. You're going to take away somebody that's worked for me for near 20 plus years, and I have no other people in this area that are competent in construction to run my jobs. So basically, I'm going to be bankrupted by the Trump administration saying Honduran TPS is over July 31st. I had to suspend work New Year's Eve. Because even though my man paid his $500 to get their TPS, then I was stalled by 6 weeks that I could not legally pay them and had to suspend work and economy because this TPS stalling by the Trump administration.
All right, Jay. I appreciate the call, and I appreciate that point of view. It's another point of view we hadn't thought about. So thank you for the call, and I hope that you don't have to go into bankruptcy. But, you know, let's wait and see what happens when these deadlines kick in. Thank you again for the call, Jay.
No, it won't be bankruptcy. I'll just retire.
Right, okay, well, then he'll retire. Then you'll retire. I hope that you're not forced into that. But, again, I have to let you go. Thank you again for the call and for that perspective. Marlon, how often do you see the Haitian community dealing with this deadline? Because he was talking about Hondurans. But numerous groups have lost their TPS protection. How often do you see the Haitians working with these different groups? Because you're all kind of in the same situation.
Yes, indeed. Realize that the Trump administration waited for so long, even after they terminated TPS. Right? They waited so long to get the guidelines out. That's how, remember he talked about he had to spend 6 weeks. It's because even though the TPS recipients applied for the work permit, they waited for a long time to get the guidelines out for Honduras, for Haiti, and for Salvador, right? And some people lost their jobs. Luckily, he just postponed paying for 6 weeks, but other folks lost their jobs, and this happens very often. A lot of Haitians lost their employment, and some were in my office last week because of the length of time it took for the Trump administration, something they could do in a few hours. It took them weeks before they could put the guidelines out, and people lost their jobs.
You were talking earlier about how you're also helping people try to move their wealth and their possessions to protect it. And some of these folks have businesses. It's not that they're employed. They're employers.
They are employers, yes.
What happens in that situation?
We haven't had a case like that, but at least we are getting the information to people. What they can do. I know for a fact that some members, some TPS holders, not necessarily from Haiti, some TPS holders from Salvador, because they've been here for a long time, what they are passing the wealth to their children, adult children. That's one way I see them doing it. And of course, FAM is a member of the National TPS Alliance, and then they just filed a lawsuit yesterday. ACLU just filed a lawsuit on their behalf, and on behalf of Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan yesterday. So what I see them doing is passing their wealth through their adult children. That's one way of doing it.
Let me get Enrique here from Sunny Isles. Enrique, welcome to the program.
Hey there. How are you doing?
Good. Go ahead, Enrique.
Very interesting topic, and it's amazing how well intricate I'm into it. Actually, I was born in Chile, and I was raised in Brazil, and I've been living in Miami for 25 years, which the very first 10 years I was doing all kinds of work, where I worked a long time on in the restaurant business. And if you see any kitchen in South Florida, 80%, 90% of those hardworking people, they're all of them are Haitian. It's just amazing. Right now at this time, my parents live in Chile. They cultivate flowers in Chile, and they have a Haitian worker, and it's amazing how hard this guy works. But unfortunately, I see that everywhere, even with my Brazilian friends or even on the social media groups that I already participate. I see a lot of Brazilians asking to come here. How would it be with all the, you know, the problems and everything? And every time you try to tell anybody that this is not the place to come, that this is not the time to come, that everything is going to be hard, people will start saying that you are a bad person, that you're not trying to encourage anybody, it's just amazing. And the same thing I see happening in Brazil and in Chile. Brazil and Chile have been having migration from all over South Florida, from all over South America, from Peru, from Colombia, from Venezuela, now from Haiti. So you have people from all over the world thinking that it's paradise to live on those countries. But it's not true. It's as hard as it is to live in here. So living here 25 years, I don't see myself living anywhere else anymore. You know, I'm already well-rooted. I have kids that were born in Miami. You know, I'm totally a Miami. So I don't see myself going back to Brazil. And I think, and that's why I tell everybody nowadays, I think it's just, why is it that America, it is what it is nowadays? And I think most of it is just because people never left the United States anywhere else. They fought until they couldn't no more to change this country to a better country. And unfortunately, all these countries, what they need is a lot of is just fighting over to get the government to straighten up and to have the economy going on the right direction and to get them moving on. In Chile and Brazil, both of them have a horrible problem in history with military governments that changed
Enrique,
the constitution in such a way that
it's
very hard to change.
I apologize only because of time, but I appreciate the story because the other thing, too, is that, you, as you said, you've been here so long. You make roots in a place. It's hard to leave. Enrique, thank you for the call. In the short time that I have, Marlene, I just wanted to ask again to remind people where they can go if they have questions. You know, what are their next options? Who should they reach out to?
Reach out to FAM. We are at 100 Northeast 84th Street. Our phone number is 305-756-8050. You can also reach out to AIJ, American for Immigrant Justice. Let's see if I remember the number by heart, 305-573-1100. You can also reach to Catholic Charities Legal Services. And thank God for the internet. You can Google and then find out where to go.
And again, we'll post those numbers up as well, so in case you missed that. Marlene Bastian, again, Executive Director of FAM, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you again tomorrow.